Hey there, good people in Cryptoland. I'm Matt Leising. This is my podcast, Decent People. Welcome back to The Conversation. Today on the show, I spoke with Jesse Schrader, who is the co-founder of Amboss Technologies. Amboss is helping make the Lightning Network easier to use. Lightning is a layer two payment network that sits on top of the Bitcoin blockchain and makes it so that payments can be a lot faster and a lot cheaper, so you don't have to go through the waiting period in the Bitcoin blockchain of sometimes 10 minutes before a transaction is approved. We got all into that, had a fascinating discussion. We talked about his background growing up in Los Angeles, how he worked for the Oregon Department of Transportation, and about how similar mapping out roads and highways is to what he's doing now at Amboss with mapping out ways that you can navigate different lightning nodes on the network, so you know where you how the easiest way to get from point A to point B in a payment system. We talked about his time in Nashville, where he's now headquartered, and it was just a great conversation. So if you want to dig into Lightning and the Bitcoin blockchain and what's going on in that world, we've got a great show for you. As always, thanks a lot for your support, and I hope you enjoy it. Hey, Jesse, how you doing?
Doing very well, Matt. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thank you for being here and welcome to the show. I am looking forward to talking to you about Bitcoin and the Lightning Network. You're the co-founder at Amboss Technologies, which is, don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think it's sort of safe to say that you guys are helping map the Lightning Network so that folks know what's going on with nodes and whatnot. And we'll jump all into that in due time. But I like to start with asking guests, you know, kind of about what current events and what's going on. We are, seems like we're in a new rally here. Bitcoin, I think, is above $56,000 today. Just wondering, I know you've been around a little while, you've seen some ups and downs. I'm curious as to what you think's going on and what might be kind of what your take is on the recent rally and whether there's like some fundamental stuff going on, kind of foundational, or what you think is the reason for this.
It's a big question. And Bitcoin is like going through an ongoing learning. I mean, people are discovering Bitcoin. And I think last cycle, kind of what we saw was a lot of talk and ideas about institutional adoption of Bitcoin. But yeah, this cycle, now that we have an ETF, now people are really going to experience what scarcity means. And what scarcity looks like when it's met with the demands of institutional investors and essentially all of the folks that have been exposed to fiat currencies, and now they're looking to Bitcoin, thinking, you know, maybe I want to put a small allocation of my retirement fund into this new asset that is taking off. That is seeing flows that outpace most other tech stocks or tech ETFs. So this is kind of where the rubber meets the road as far as people really understanding what Bitcoin means and what the price does. I think people are still learning what the Bitcoin, the technology, really means for people. From a human rights perspective, as well as for payments.
Yeah, that's a great point. And the ETF, I think, is fascinating because for people who might not understand it, the way an ETF works is, you know, you send some of your 401k money to, I don't know, BlackRock or Fidelity, and that they have to buy that amount of Bitcoin to support your investment. So there's this huge buying pressure right now. The inflows have been incredible. The amount of money going in there. So of course it could be the opposite. There could be selling, but I think there's so much interest and curiosity about the ETFs that we're seeing, you know, the buying way outpace the selling right now. And now you've got these like huge players who are in the market and with, you know, this big demand. So I find that really fascinating. It took long enough to get it through the SEC. But that's enough for probably a whole different podcast. Are you seeing, you mentioned some other things like, private rights and other things. Like, do you feel like, is there another segment that's coming back to the market that is interested in those sorts of things rather than this institutional buying to support the ETF market that we have now?
When it comes to rights, I'm not totally sure I know exactly what you mean, but when I think of Bitcoin, the technology and the powers that it gives people, it is essentially pure freedom to really do what you want. Now, like an institutional setup, like an ETF, is going to have guardrails to say you can or cannot do something with this asset. But Bitcoin has no restrictions. It is simply restricted by valid or invalid. Do you have the money or don't you? And that really determines whether you can make a transaction. There's other things going on in the fiat world outside of Bitcoin about like relationships between countries. And Bitcoin does not recognize borders. It doesn't care if you're black, white, brown or purple. It really doesn't care. Even a robot or a human, it does not care. And that is pure freedom. I mean, this is valid or invalid. So kind of the ETF structure is layering on restrictions, whereas Bitcoin does not have any restrictions. Now, when it comes to like human rights or the ability for someone to take their savings and escape inflation, escape hyperinflation, or to actually leave their country and take their savings and their value across borders, Bitcoin is a massively enabling technology where someone can simply memorize 12 words and cross a border with it and then still have their savings and their accrued generational wealth available at their disposal.
Yeah. It's also really fascinating in places like Africa where everybody has a mobile phone, but not many people have a bank account, that, this is kind of weaving its way into payment structures in that part of the world. And also, it's proven to be really good for remittance payments for folks who are sending money back home. So I wanted to kind of delve back a little bit into your background. I was doing some research and I noticed, looks like you grew up in Los Angeles in Palos Verdes. Is that correct?
I did. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a fascinating place. I'm in Los Angeles now. It's where I grew up. So the thing I knew about Palos Verdes most times was going by on my sailboat on the way to Catalina. I kind of wave to the peninsula before you cross the channel. And I remember, I've never actually been to Palos Verdes, but the closest I got was on the sailboat. We were coming back one time and the engine died and there was no wind. And so suddenly we were starting to drift towards the peninsula. And for those who don't know, it's like rocky cliffs. It's not, there's barely a beach there. So my dad is down below and he's like on the radio with, it's like this sailboat AAA kind of thing where you can call like, hey, I have an emergency. I need to come, somebody needs to come like get us and tow us. And I'm at the helm and we're getting closer and closer to the rocks. And suddenly the wind came up and thank God we got a breeze and we were able to start sailing. My dad ended up sailing the boat all the way back into Marina del Rey that day. And he sailed all the way right into the slip, which is really tough to do. So I was very impressed. What was it like growing up in Palos Verdes? What were your parents doing?
Let's see. Palos Verdes was an interesting place to grow up. It's a place with incredible privilege. It is essentially where celebrities will go to like hide away and to not really interact with the fans that they might
it's a
have.
Bit off the beaten track in LA for sure.
For sure. And it's kind of like you're optimizing for different things. It's to move away from society a bit. And you will have very limited exposure to like the broader public. It was interesting because, I carpooled to school with someone who won an Oscar were her, whose parents won an Oscar, which was just, you know, completely different than like my own like background and like my own economic situation. Because like my family was like had owned that house for a while. So I, you know, I wasn't in touch with, you know, that level of wealth, even close to it. And so I had a slightly different perspective on kind of the scarcity of resources where others were, you know, really enjoying the opulence of the time.
Yeah. Are you familiar with the book, The Falcon and the Snowman?
I am, yeah.
Yeah, that's a great story. So there were two kids, they went to Palos Verdes High and they ended up starting to sell secrets to the Soviets, right?
No kidding. Yeah.
Yeah. Really crazy. That's always stuck in my head, I think, because I was roughly around their age, I think, when that happened in the 80s. Always kind of was kind of a cool thing. It looks like then you went up to Humboldt to go to college at Humboldt State.
I did. Humboldt was pretty eye-opening for me. So once again, it is like a secluded place of Northern California. It's nestled in the redwoods. And it is a place where there's thriving community. There is a farmer's market that happens every Saturday and basically the whole town comes out. It's also like the marijuana capital of the world. So there's a lot of, you know, folks operating in the hills in largely cash economies that, you know, like every fall rolls around and people will start to flood in to do trimming activity. So they'll be going for a week at a time into these well off the beaten path locations to simply trim weed. And then some of that gets sold to dispensaries. Some of that, I was going to college at a time when like marijuana was not legal recreationally. So there was a massive amount of cash, which also like posed a significant risk because dispensaries overall weren't able to get bank accounts. Mm-hmm. And that's something that Jack Maulers has kind of tapped into as like one of the first use cases of Strike and kind of the banking situation that dispensaries are put in when you have that much cash on hand as a business, it really puts you at risk for armed robbery. One dispensary, for example, did monthly payroll all in cash for their entire staff, which means that they had 10 employees, like that amount of cash on hand at a single point.
Yeah, and you're just if a any, sitting duck, aren't like, you?
Yeah. So like this is a massive risk. So anytime I encounter a whole bunch of cash, I'm just thinking about like, you know, you become a target for armed robbery. And it's something that El Salvador is now benefiting from. If you move your money digitally, you can avoid a lot of the violence and a lot of the targeting that can happen when criminals want to take what you have.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember the joke back in those days was you don't go hiking in Humboldt unless you want to get shot. Because there's so many farms and so much stuff out there that, you know, people just don't want you messing around with. Did you take those experiences with you, like when you discovered Bitcoin and kind of it all sort of clicked into place about the chance to have digital cash and not have to have like physical fiat on hand?
It was certainly a thought. You know, I studied environmental engineering, so it's, you know, trying to take technology and apply them to solve real problems. So lots of my background was kind of physics, and I took off to Portland to find a job because, you know, Humboldt isn't, overflowing with jobs. And so yeah. I moved to a larger city. There again, I struggled because they really weren't hiring environmental engineers. They were at a time, you know, following the great financial crisis where a lot of engineering employees were really hanging on to their jobs because of uncertainty about the economy. And so I took a temp job and I worked in a call center that handled class action lawsuits. And most of those class action lawsuits were levied against banks. So banks were doing funny little things like reorganizing debit card transactions to maximize overdraft fees, which to me felt fundamentally wrong. It wasn't illegal. And so my job was to talk to people that were part of this class action lawsuit that were calling and asking questions about the notice that they received in the mail. And so at that point, after seeing the fact that banks would institute policies that were really against their customers and against their customers' best interest, that's what motivated me to really look for alternatives and see what else could be done.
What did those class action lawsuits ever get settled, or what was the outcome?
Generally, when it became a class action lawsuit, and by the time it got to me, it was a settlement. And so this was when they were about to issue checks.
I see.
And, you know, I could see the check amount and the amount of, you know, damages. And I could see that the payout from the settlement was really going to be a small fraction of the actual damages.
It's like a cost of doing business kind of thing.
Totally.
For the banks.
About a third of the settlement is going to go to lawyers.
Right.
Another fraction is going to go to the settlement administrator, which is kind of where the call center fits in. Mm. And then at the end of the day, the actual customer of the bank that didn't have a lot of options to like find another bank that didn't have that policy, they just get a fraction of what they were actually owed.
Yeah, it's crazy. And then I love stories like yours where you have this really interesting, varied background. So from there, I think you started working. You worked for the Oregon Department of Transportation for a little while, and then you were an engineering associate at the City of Portland. You were working on like traffic stuff and things like that. Was that sort of where you found yourself?
Yeah, actually, working for ODOT, the Oregon Department of Transportation, that. They have a highway network to maintain. Mm-hmm. And the question for them is, where do they allocate resources in order to extend the life and improve the performance of their entire highway system? The state of Oregon actually has an incredible highway system. And it would be a shame if they weren't able to maintain it. So I think a lot of people focus on potholes when they like experience a road. And they think patching potholes is what a city has to do. But really, like, if you've got potholes, like, that road is essentially dead. You know, you're just essentially just patching a wound that is not stopping. And really, the work happens way ahead of time at the foundation level. Because if you can do routine maintenance, and that is before you get to the pothole stage, you can actually extend the life of the highway system. And so it was a big engineering allocation and asset management problem. And it all fits into a network. And I love to use transportation networks as analogies for the lightning network.
Yeah, that's a good one. Before we go on to that, did you ever see the movie Singles?
I haven't.
Oh, okay. There's a character in that movie and it's set in Seattle, but he works for the city, planning department. And he just always is asking people, hey, do you ever think about traffic? Everyone always says no. So anyway, it just made me think of that. Getting onto like Lightning, was it during this period that Bitcoin came out and you discovered it, or how did you come across it in the first place?
Yeah, I think my first exposure to it was, I remember back in like 2014, I found a faucet where I could, you know, watch some ads, that would give you Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Now, pretty cool. I watched a whole bunch of ads, see how much I could get. And then quickly found a site where I could gamble them away, and I promptly did that. So I think it was like a dice rolling game.
Was it Satoshi
but essentially
dice?
All of the, probably Satoshi dice.
Yeah.
I don't actually remember, but the Bitcoin was gone after that point. And then I didn't really rediscover it until, you know, we got some more price action in 2017. Mm-hmm. And that's when I first, like, made my first purchase, saw basically what the price could do, really skyrocketing. I think it tripled from where I first purchased. And then, like, as the price descended and descended rapidly, I was answering the question for myself of, like, do I sell this thing? Because I don't like losing money. So what was it that I actually purchased? And that's where I discovered Andreas Antonopoulos and kind of the message of Bitcoin as, like, you know, a punk rock tech that actually gives people control back over their financial lives and was a true answer to a lot of the issues that I saw at the class action lawsuits and adversarial policies against customers.
Yeah. And did you also at that time notice the congestion in the network? I remember things were pretty bad in November, December 2017 when I was moving some Bitcoin that I'd gotten my mom, and I had to pay $30 to move $100 worth of Bitcoin from an exchange to a wallet for her. And that made a big impression on me.
Oh, I felt that pain. I felt that pain big. I wanted to buy Christmas gifts from my parents with Bitcoin in November of 2017, back when fees were above $30 for, in my case. And I tried to purchase a gift through Overstock.com. And that was like one of the few sites that accepted Bitcoin. But one funny thing about their payment system is that the payment needed to be delivered and confirmed within 15 minutes. Now, if you understand Bitcoin, on average, you get a confirmation every 10 minutes. In order for it to really be confirmed, really you need like three confirmations at least.
Yeah, three more blocks to follow it, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of a protection against competing chains and like which what's the longest chain?
Right.
So the payment didn't go through on the first time, and I had already paid $30 just in fees.
In fees? Oh yeah.
And so they refunded the transaction to me so that I could make another attempt so it would actually be delivered in 15 minutes. That was a horrible experience.
Yeah.
And I was immediately on the lookout for how do I make this payment system better?
And I think, did Lightning kind of come out of that? Was that, there was a paper written right around that time, I think, where it all started.
So the Lightning Network paper, the white paper came out in 2015. And so this was really where the engineering work was happening. It takes several years just to go from an idea into a white paper and then from a white paper to actual implementation. And 2018, it was like the end of 2017, early 2018 that the Lightning Network actually started. And I was keenly interested in this just to solve some of these payment pain points. And yeah, so I started messing around with it, downloaded, I think, the Eclair mobile wallet and created a channel fully on mobile. That wallet is no longer around, but I started feeding chickens over the Lightning Network using Poyo Feed, which is one of the early sites. It's just like a video streaming, and you make a small payment, like 10 cents or even less, and some food gets dropped for the chickens. So you get to see them run over on this live stream. You know, of course, like now there's a whole bunch of, you know, copycats and improvements that have been made so you can feed chickens far more effectively now.
Yeah, you've got to make it fun, right?
Yeah.
Was it hard for you? I mean, you were coming, you said, like, more from a traditional engineering background with a physics background and things like that. But was the learning curve steep for you to get into this? Did you, like, try to delve into the code, or how was that for you?
I think from environmental engineering, like, one of the concepts is that you take a very complex system and you identify, like, what can you actually control here? You look for the control variables and you look at some of the outcomes. And when approaching a problem like that, you can look at something like the Lightning Network, like a natural system, and you've got people that are creating channels to each other. I mean, overall, this is it's a very abstract idea, but it's an abstract idea that means a lot to people.
Well, yeah.
Essentially, you own the payment
more
system.
For people, if they don't know what we're actually talking about, but it's basically Lightning is a layer 2 network on top of Bitcoin, right? So you can set up a channel, like you're saying, and do a whole bunch of transactions that are off chain, and they're not, you don't need to confirm every one of them. And then when you come back around and you're done and you want to close it, I believe, tell me if I'm wrong, but then all of those transactions get kind of put onto the main mainnet, the Bitcoin blockchain. And so there is a record of them, but you're not going to the network every time you want to just move a little bit of money. Do I have that right?
Almost. So I think in general, what you have is you can treat these Lightning channels like a joint account. So between you and I, we could say, you know, we're going to start a joint account. I'll put $100 in just to start, and you put in zero, but I'll give you access. And whenever I want to pay you, we'll both sign a transaction that can be broadcast at any time on the Bitcoin blockchain that says Jesse gets $100 and Matt gets $0. And then when I pay you, say I pay you $5, we'll both sign a transaction that says when we decide to close this joint account, Jesse will get $95 and Matt will get $5. And both of us sign it, and it's ready to be broadcast at any time. But really, this is a ledger on the side.
Yeah.
And the Bitcoin blockchain has no knowledge of the transactions that we've done. It's really between you and I, we have a side ledger. And so the Bitcoin blockchain doesn't need to know about that. It just needs to know about the net settlement.
Yeah, that's a great way of explaining it. This is something I understand. It's similar to opening a bar tab, right? Where you just order drinks and it's like between you and the bartender, and your bank account doesn't have any idea about it until you close it out and then you pay your bill. So it's clear that it just kind of captured your imagination and you wanted to learn more about it. But what was that's different than co-founding Amboss and like jumping in with everything you've got. So what was there a moment that you like had to do that, or was there something that you experienced that made you think, you know, this is what needs to be done?
I could see that the technology was far better than anything else out there, but I could see that the user experience was really suffering. So, you know, me being an engineer, I see some beautiful possibilities with a lot of problems that need to be solved. And these are engineering problems. They're UX problems. It's interfacing between a technology and humans. And there's tons of problems to be solved there. So we took an incremental approach to say, okay, we're dealing with something that is just code. My co-founder who started ThunderHub turned that code into a node management software. And so you could actually see in a nice user interface kind of what's going on your node. What is your balance? Who are you connected to? All of these things. And that makes it more real. You've got things that you could click on and connections to make. And it moves Bitcoin around to create a decentralized payment system. So that was kind of where we started jumping off from. And this is inherent to any decentralized network. is there's a discoverability problem. So how do I find out about who to connect to when I want to create a payment system? And there was this idea of a Lightning Network Explorer. And the first one out there was 1ml.com. And there was basically somebody's project that they shipped and turned it into a website. But we saw that there was a lot of user experience improvements to be made. And so so Tony, who started ThunderHub, and I teamed up to form Amboss, and amboss.space is where you can see our Lightning Network Explorer. And it really kicked off some serious evolution that is done as like a data analytics hub for kind of what's happening on the Lightning Network. How do you optimize your experience?
And so help me understand this part. Based on what type of user I am I looking for a different type of hub to connect to? Are there some hubs that are like, I can move more money through this, and then there are other hubs that it's more like micropayments, or how does that work?
Yeah. So at this point, I'll go back to a transportation analogy.
Yeah, good.
So if you want to get from point A to point B with your payments, you actually have to route between a whole bunch of joint accounts. So in that, like when kind of navigating through these joint accounts, you could look at them like a highway under construction, or maybe there's a low overpass and I want to send a big truck through a route. So if I want to send a big truck and there's low overpasses, I'm going to need to find another route. And so really this Amboss helps map the Lightning Network because it's individual connections and there's difficult routing problems that need to be solved. And each one of them functions like a toll road. So you're going to pay a fee depending on how much money you're going to move. And there's lots of optimizations. There's cost trade-offs and also constraints. Like, can I actually get from point A to point B? And then the next question is, you know, what's a reliable route? What's an inexpensive route?
That's really fascinating that there's such a parallel there between what you were doing in transportation previously and now. I mean, do you ever just kind of sit back and say, wow, that's a little bit crazy?
Oh, it's so weird. It is so weird. You know, mainly what environmental engineers do is they work on dams and water reservoirs. We haven't, you know, talked about this much, but when there isn't enough money to be processed in a single joint account in one of these channels, you say that it's a liquidity issue. And this is so relevant. So
it's like the dam is run dry.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like you can't pump water if there's no water to be pumped. So it was just a little uncanny how well it worked out, but you know, I've got this background trying to find out where I can help out. And just so happens that I've got a background that kind of lends itself to this.
Yeah, for sure. Was there a moment after you guys started Amboss where you kind of felt like, okay, this is going to work, this is taking off?
We launched the Amboss.space Explorer in May of 2021. And I quit my job in June of 2021.
That was a huge, the heyday, right?
If
I remember correctly, things were going crazy about that time.
It was shortly after the El Salvador announcement that they would be adopting Bitcoin.
Right.
It was about a month after this community group called PlebNet started up. And the idea behind PlebNet, if I can speak for them, was like recognizing that El Salvador now needs to use Bitcoin as their payment system. Like that's the law. Mm-hmm. And the recognition that also Bitcoin transaction fees are multiple dollars and will take, you know, over 10 minutes in order just to be confirmed one time. Like knowing those two facts, El Salvador needs the Lightning Network to function. And who is going to do that? You know, no company is in a great position to like make that happen for them on day one. And so the PlebNet movement started up to say, I'm going to bootstrap a payment system that the people of El Salvador will be able to benefit from. And AMBOS launched like right during that time to help. It really functioned to help organize people to create useful and meaningful infrastructure for payments.
Yeah. It's been just as an aside, how do you think it's going in El Salvador? It's hard to get a good sense of it. I think if you're not in the country, do you think it's working, or what's your take on that right now?
I think there's a lot of positive directions. I think people have online or internet capable banking for the first time ever. There's also just a lot of kind of complicating factors to really speak to how Bitcoin is working for the people of El Salvador. I think, you know, based on my two trips there, education was the biggest pain point. I think people just didn't really understand like what it was that, you know, Bitcoin was or how to use it. But there's some incredible movements around educating and really starting with kids mm-hmm. to say that, you know, as part of your education, you can get a certificate to show that, you know, you understand Bitcoin, and then you can help other people kind of navigate this system.
Yeah, just it's not
creating
such a big
wallet,
deal.
Restoring a wallet.
Yeah, exactly. I was just gonna say, it's not a big deal for a kid to create a wallet, right? It's like, it's something that they can just sort of adapt to, I think, a lot more quickly than somebody who's older. I remember doing some reporting on it and talking to people down there. And one of the things that I came away with was how everybody said that this is now giving people hope in El Salvador, that their money, that they can save, you know, and that they'll have an asset that won't get deflated away. I was told this one story that people would, they would use cinder blocks as a form of currency because they would hold their value better I can't remember what they use. I think they use the US dollar. No, they don't use, I can't remember. But anyway, cinder blocks were like their store of value. And when they needed something, you know, they would sell those. That just kind of always stayed with me. And you talked about community before, like in Humboldt, and obviously Bitcoin, that's a big aspect of it and the movement. How do you see the Bitcoin community and there's obviously been some splits in the past and arguments and things, but is that something that drew you to it as well?
You know, no. Actually, I think my first response or my first like seeing Bitcoin out there in 2017, I was just completely annoyed by all the memes. I mean, people were celebrating, the price was pumping, and I was like, God, I cannot tolerate this. Like, okay, either I need them to shut up and I just unsubscribe from this subreddit, or I need to join the party. And I'm so thankful that I joined the party and enjoyed some of the things that Bitcoin can bring as far as, you know, preservation of wealth, as well as just the scarcity and demand dynamics that causes the price to pump. But that said, I've really fallen in love with the Bitcoin community. Let's see. On the one hand, they're very thoughtful. I mean, it's a community of builders, and they are very missionary focused. They want to do great things with money, because we've had such a nasty history of inflation, of other thefts from people that the Bitcoin really solves. And if we can just build a little bit more, you know, we can make Bitcoin like so undeniably attractive that no one will ever want to move back into an inferior system, back to fiat.
And do you see that supplanting kind of the banking system or the banking payment system like SWIFT and some of the other, you know, correspondent banking networks that are out there? Or is this more for individual use? Like, where do you think it's going to come down?
When I first got into Bitcoin, I did think that Bitcoin would replace the banks. It would be the death of banks. It would be the death of payment systems. But I don't think that anymore, because more likely than not, companies are going to adapt to technology. But you know, Bitcoin already has a distinct advantage, and Bitcoiners in general, because they understand this tech, and there is a massive learning curve. So I think other companies and other payment systems, other banks will adopt this technology. I think it will take them a long time, and they will be late to the party.
Do you see them doing it on like the public Bitcoin blockchain, or do you think they're going to use it more as an internal system between like a group of banks, like a private network?
They will certainly have private connections between banks. And kind of knowing the history of banks, there's a lot of information going in and not a lot of information leaving. But I think in general, banks will try to avoid a whole bunch of, you know, public activity. But I think the Lightning Network actually functions for that very well. And there's serious trade-offs to selecting a private channel, which is just not announced, but still happens on the blockchain, versus a public channel where you're saying, there's a road here and I'll charge a toll for you to route transactions through this. I think the public infrastructure is far more valuable than any of the private channels, because the private channels can't form a network that is interoperable, and people will actually have a whole bunch of cash management issues when they build using private channels.
Yeah, that's a great point. One thing that banks are known for or you know used for is liquidity, like we were talking about before, and you guys have come up with a solution for that. So if a business is using the Lightning Network, but they don't suddenly have the money that they would need, that there's a an option for them. Can you tell me a little bit more about that and how it's working for you guys?
Yeah. So we started a marketplace, which we called Magma. And this is really just a copy of what was happening in early Telegram chats in the early days of the Lightning Network, where, you know, someone says, well, I want to receive payments, but I need someone to open a Lightning channel to me. Mm-hmm. It is directional because of this joint account dynamic that we described earlier. And by whenever you you know, have a conversation, you can almost turn this into a protocol. And so we created a marketplace, essentially a marketplace platform for people to say, hey, I'm willing to open a channel to you, but I'm going to charge you because I have to pay transaction fees in order to create this channel infrastructure. And at the end of the channel's life, I'm going to have to pay another transaction fee. Mm-hmm. So I only have so much Bitcoin. Who am I going to connect to? So I can set a price for me opening a channel to you. I don't really care who you are, but this is how much I charge. Yeah. So far, we've done a little over 160 Bitcoin in Lightning channels. So this is individuals connecting to individuals, and they use the marketplace to find the best price and to see which connections are strategic and which ones aren't.
Yeah. I was going to say, in traditional finance, it sounds like market makers that you're bringing people together, right? So they're not necessarily speculating, but they are like, hey, I've got some liquidity and I'll charge you a little bit for it so that you don't, you know, the channel doesn't go dry, I guess is a way of saying it.
Yeah, I don't think we characterize ourselves as market makers, but we've kind of organized a system that solves a need, and that is, you know, what's called the inbound liquidity problem. But all in all, it's fixing the problem of people need to get paid using this Lightning Network system, and how do we improve the payment reliability? And that's really by opening more channels, having more connections to the rest of the network.
Yeah. What is I noticed on your website you have sort of averages of what's going over. I don't know if it was just AmBOSS or if it was Lightning in general, but is the majority of it like micropayments, or I'm not sure you'd call it Lightning or micropayments, but just small amounts? I noticed a lot of it was denominated in Satoshis, which is the, you know, the lowest Bitcoin value you can go down to. Are you seeing it used for that sort of thing mostly, or are there other people moving, I don't know, like 5 or 10 Bitcoin right now? You know, that could be up to almost $500,000.
You know, the Lightning Network is best at small payments. It can do larger payments, but the other thing to note is that AmBOSS or any participant in the Lightning Network doesn't really know how many transactions are going through. What you can see is the public infrastructure. I can see how many roads are out there and, you know, whom they're connected to, but I can't see how many cars drive along those paths unless I own the infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And so every node that operates, you could think of a node as like a city. It kind of has, it has knowledge on how many cars are coming in and how many cars are leaving. But you don't have general knowledge of the entire network. And so that it's a difficult question to answer. But, you know, based on, you know, my experience, it's largely small payments. However, you know, like I've done far larger payments than is normal, just within a single Lightning channel.
And is that that lack of knowledge of the entire network, is that by design, or is that because what we talked about earlier, like the layer two, where you're doing a lot of things off chain and then you're coming back on chain? Is that, can you help me understand that?
Yeah, it is by design. What we have in the Lightning Network is payment level privacy. I don't need to communicate to the rest of the world every payment that I do. And so that is a huge design advantage that it has over any blockchain solution. So the Lightning Network structure is more private. I think it's massive for consumers because, mm-hmm. like, I think we've all existed under a surveillance capitalism like world. I mean, Visa, Chase, American Express, they all know about all of your payments. And they're able to sell all sorts of things to you because that data just gets wholesaled to advertisers. And then they're going to use that information using machine learning algorithms to really optimize you spending on whatever have you. Now, I don't want those companies to have all that information, which I like the Lightning Network. I like the fact that no one has complete knowledge of this system. Like, Even for AmBOSS trying to do data analytics, there's tons of unknowns. Like, we have no ability to really know how many transactions are going through the Lightning Network, even though that's like one of the biggest questions that we always get asked. But the answer is we don't know, and that's by design.
I like that too. I love the privacy aspect, but it makes me wonder, get concerned about the regulatory maybe response to that lack of knowledge? Has that come up? Is that something that concerns you?
Has it come up? I'm glad that you're asking this question because we just announced our latest product, which is on the risk management front. Because we noticed, we did interviews of Lightning Network companies. We interviewed 26 of them just to try and identify what their biggest pain points were. Mm-hmm. And we found that most of them were struggling with accounting, user experience, liquidity, and regulation. And the regulatory experience that they have is some of them build incredible technology, but they're not able to release it outside of maybe a beta because the regulator sees this Lightning Network system and they say, hey, that's private payments. You can't do that. You're going to be funding money launderers and terrorists. And what we saw is that the business really didn't have any tools to say, no, that's not the case. We're just trying to run a business using better payment technology that is more private. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And so we built a system that we're calling Reflex, which does simple checks based on a business's policies. So it's all configurable. And it says basically, okay, do any of my peers, did any of them use funds from the OFAC list in order to create channels? If so, like, then it will just not pass that check. And that will inform the business, you know, maybe they want to close that channel. Mm-hmm. Or do any of my peers, are any of my peers operating in sanctioned jurisdictions? And if so, you could close those connections so that the business can actually launch their product and say, you know, I'm proactively monitoring for, you know, terrorist funds and money laundering, and I'm not connecting to any sanctioned countries. Mm-hmm. Just to get your product out there, because like, an economy is a massive network effect, and I need these businesses to launch and be successful, because that's the only way that Amboss is going to be successful and the Lightning Network is going to be successful as a payment system, as a more private payment system. I have to get the regulators on board. Yeah. I have to get the businesses using this.
Yeah, that's really cool. It's like a red flag kind of system to let you know if you're getting into trouble. How's it going? Are you seeing, is it getting good traction?
We just launched it on Thursday, beta.
Wow. Okay.
Congrats. So we are keenly interested in, you know, finding out, you know, does this answer all the problems that people are experiencing when talking to regulators, and also to maintain banking relationships? Because that's the other thing, is that businesses, when they've got a bank account and the bank account sees that, oh, you're using this Lightning Network private payment system, it's like they terminate the bank account. Right. And that's a killer for businesses. So I need them to be successful. And if they can maintain banking relationships, get past regulators and launch their products, like, that's going to be an endless stream of winning for Reflex, this payment operations suite.
That's great. Good luck with that.
Thank you.
You know, I've always, a little more broadly, just speaking about Bitcoin, I've always thought it's a fantastic payment, you know, solution, the first of its kind that succeeded. And I've read some things that you've written about where people are trying to expand what Bitcoin can do, like with ordinals and writing into, you know, empty block space. I guess I've never quite understood why that's necessary when Bitcoin does such a good job at what it does, you know, sort of holistically. What is it like? What do you think people should still be trying to stretch and do things more with Bitcoin? Or, I mean, I think the Lightning Network is great because it solves this issue of, you know, the time to transactions and the fees that are involved. But do you think there's room for more for the protocol to expand in other ways?
Definitely. I have only faith that, you know, people will use Bitcoin for, you know, just all the use cases that they can, mm-hmm. especially just these concepts of being anti-fragile, into being something that can't be stopped. This is incredibly powerful technology, but it's also very attractive for, you know, someone to introduce, you know, JPEGs or even new tokens into the Bitcoin blockchain, because it really can't be stopped, and it will be widely distributed globally at very low cost to actually participate. So it's a gift and a curse in a way. But, you know, for me, it's essential that Bitcoin be function as money. And so that's a big piece of this. And the Lightning Network ensures that you can scale Bitcoin payments, and you can actually get way more commerce happening in a single blockchain.
Yeah. You mentioned anti-fragile. That's a great place to tell me what Amboss means in German.
Amboss is the German word for anvil.
Like you're forging a strength or a strong network.
Exactly. It's basically my role in the company to come up with the names of our new products.
I'm sure you do much more than that.
I, I do, actually. but it's one of my favorite jobs to do. But Amboss, we put a lot of thought into the name to create a really robust platform to do work on Lightning. And I thought it fit very well with all of the existing imagery that has to do with Lightning, including Thor and his hammer, Mjolnir, and all the sparks. So it was really fun to introduce some of that blacksmith ideology into Lightning.
Yeah, it's very on brand. Well done. Are you now in Nashville?
I am. Just a couple of blocks from Bitcoin Park.
Okay. Yeah, I've talked to other people about the tech scene there, and I've heard it's really good. I was talking to Tara Fung a little while ago. She's at Co-Create. I don't know if you know Tara, but what is the scene like in Nashville these days?
I'm still adjusting to it, but what I can tell from Bitcoin Park is that there's really something special happening here.
What is Bitcoin Park?
Bitcoin Park is a co-working space today, and it was the old recording studio for the Florida Georgia Line, very popular band from Nashville, and these guys converted their like two houses essentially into a co-working space. And Rod and Matt O'Dell have kind of teamed up to really create Bitcoin Park and make it a destination for Bitcoiners to build companies and to network. And it really evolved from just the incredible attendance that they had at Bitcoin meetups in Nashville. I mean, people are ready for Bitcoin in this area. I've never seen it quite like this before. Coming from Portland, coming from LA, people are not that ready for Bitcoin in those areas. But here in Nashville, they're like, yeah.
What do you think the difference is?
I want a different money system.
What do you think? Any clues yet on to why that is?
I think people love freedom here. I know like Matt O'Dell has been pushing this idea of like Sovereign Valley, which is, I love the concept. But I got to tell you, they're having a monthly open house to learn about different topics. And at all of them, I've seen someone from the senator's office attend. It's getting the attention of not only Bitcoiners, not only entrepreneurs, but also politicians that want to understand more deeply about what Bitcoin can offer and what's happening in the industry.
Yeah, that's cool. You said earlier you really want Bitcoin to be money. Are we there yet, or where do you put us in that trajectory?
One framework I've heard is, in order for something to become money, first it's a store of value, then it's a medium of exchange, and then finally a unit of account. And so we've already proven the store of value pretty well. Bitcoin, over a 5-year period does incredibly well, and even better over a longer term period. The medium of exchange is really where Amboss is focused on making Bitcoin useful for payments. And that's where the divisibility, the portability components really come in. So we're keenly focused on making payments work by focusing on payment reliability, including some of the simulations that we do on the Lightning Network. And then the last piece, and that would be the crown jewel of Bitcoin becoming money, is a unit of account. And that's where things start getting priced in Bitcoin. And those prices are durable.
Yeah. That's cool. I like that. Well, Jesse, this has been fascinating. Thank you so much for your sharing your time and your story with me. Let people know how they can learn more about Amboss and connect with you.
For sure. And thank you so much, Matt, for having me. It's been a pleasure chatting with you. Yeah. But people can follow Amboss at Amboss Tech on Twitter. We're also on Noster. That's notes and other stuff transmitted over relays. And you can follow me on Twitter as well at Jestifer_BTC. And this is my original NIM that, now I'm fully doxxed as Jesse Schrader on the internet. Yeah. But, that was our humble beginnings as just anonymous plebs on the internet.
Yeah. Well, we all kind of get that start, don't we? Yeah. Again, Jesse, thanks so much and best of luck with everything at Amboss. And, I'll be keeping an eye on you guys, and I'd love to have you back in a little while to see how things are going.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Matt.
That's it for this episode. Thanks for joining us, and make sure to subscribe and rate us at Spotify, Amazon Music, and Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Decent People is a production of Decentral Media. It is produced by Curtis Fritsch, with music by Brian Duncan and Kareem Ives.